Okay, very good. We're in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8, talking about faith, and we're going to continue with this series as we go through this. We've come to the place of Abraham, and I want to spend on your notes from last week and the same thing we handed out this week. I want to go through chapter 11 to chapter 23. It's got to be an overview, but so when we start talking about Abraham, we've got a little bit of a perspective of his life. I know we're familiar with it, but it'd be nice to read the text. But we are in Hebrews 11, and as it begins, Hebrews chapter 11, it says, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for." And again, the idea of being sure and certain, that it's not a hope, of course. Faith is not a hope. It's a confidence that you know that these things are true because of some other evidence you've got. You may not see it, but you know for sure that it's true because this is true. This also has, it's got to reach into this result. And so these are the ancients or the elders of this chapter. And we've already gone through Abel and Enoch and Noah. They had what is called faith or confidence in the unseen. And they have confidence in this unseen because they know they have some knowledge. If you have no knowledge, if you have nothing to know, you can't have faith. That faith is not based in wishes or hopes. It's based in something that is absolute. And because you know this, faith lets you see and understand what is not yet visible, that's not yet manifest. But you're waiting for it. You know it's true. And in life, sometimes you can have situations, well, if you invest this much money in this company, for example, and this is what happens in the market, works like this, and you know this is going to be the result. But there are some things in this world that are changeable. It's a tangible world. And so you can have percentages. You can have a chance of it working out. But there's also a chance things are going to change. But when we have faith in this knowledge of God, and if it's God's promise, God says, "I am going to do this," then the economy, then the political situation, the world stage, your own decisions will not affect the promises of God. And so you know confidently that this is going to happen, if that makes sense. You can invest in the stock market, and this is going to be probably what's going to happen, but things can change all of a sudden. Well, when you invest in God, things are not going to change. His word, well, Jesus said, I mean, he sums it up. He says it so well, as you know. He says, "My heaven and earth will pass away," supporting what I'm saying. Everything in this age is temporary and is able to change. In fact, so much so that it is in the process of passing away to the point that someday it's never going to exist. But Jesus says, "My words will never pass away." So his promises are absolute. And so that's what we're talking about, having this knowledge, this understanding that God has promised, God has revealed this. You have confidence, faith, trust in this, and so you can see the unseen. Now, we're not talking about seeing visions and seeing angels. You can see by faith this is what's going to happen, especially if it's clearly a promise. Now, over here in this unseen realm, there is some, we don't understand everything. So there are some, I'll put an exclamation point, some absolutes, but how that takes place and how it's going to look, we've never been there. So there's always going to be in this area some kind of lack of understanding. In fact, Abraham is going to trust God. He's going to believe God. He's going to act on God, knowing, but not knowing where he's going. So he's going to know, have faith that this is going to happen, but I don't know where I'm going. I'm absolutely sure this is right, but I don't know where it is. And that's natural. If you knew all this, you'd have to be God himself. And so that gives us the permission, the opportunity to have confidence in God, follow God, and yet not know all the details and still live confident knowing that God is moving us towards this goal. And so that's what it says right here. The ancients were commended for. Again, in the context, 63 AD, the writer is trying to encourage the Jews of Jerusalem to put their faith in Jesus Christ and continue. And he says that's exactly what all of the heroes of the Old Testament did. They had a word from God. They had a promise from God. They didn't fully understand everything, but they still followed. One thing as we pass through this, as we go through these people that are being mentioned, and we're going to see today in today's stories, we'll go through Abraham's life, not everything they did was perfect. And that's we need to always come back to that, because that answers so many questions. Like, well, some of these guys made huge mistakes. Right. The Bible is not about people being heroes. It's about people finding God and God leading them, directing them, guiding them into His character, His nature, His promises. But they're going to stumble all the way. There are no heroes in a sense of in the Bible, except in a sense the heroes of faith. Those who, in spite of all their weaknesses and failures, they kept confidence in God and kept moving towards God. So here we go. We're going to look in verse 8, chapter 11, verse 8. After having talked about Abel and Enoch and Noah, I'm going to read the verses about Abraham. They're going to take a moment and mention Sarah in those verses. And then we're going to come back or go back to Genesis and read Abraham's account. And then we'll come back next week and kind of go through these in more detail, the writers of Hebrews. Here's what the writer of Hebrews says about Abram. By faith, Abraham. Okay, so Abraham is going to do these things because he has knowledge. He knows something, and by faith, he's going to start acting on what was promised, although he's not going to see it. He's not going to have a full understanding of it. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. So he heard and understood, and he obeyed, but didn't know where he was going. And those two things are always going to be true in faith. I know and understand this. There's no doubt about this. So I'm going to follow this. Where is it going? Well, that's the faith part. You're trusting God, who's taking you to a place that only He knows, only He can see. And it is in a sense, impossible for us in our human state to understand everything God is doing. Just by definition, God is all-knowing. We are finite with limited understanding, limited revelation. So when God says, do this, say, wait a minute, I want all the details. Okay, you can't handle all the details. If I told it to you, well, Paul, for example, went into the third heaven and saw heaven, and he comes back and he says, for example, he says, I saw things that men are not permitted to tell. And I don't think that means, shh, don't say it. It's like, I saw things, God just, oh, there it is. And I'm like, ah. So when God says, trust me, it's like, and he gives you information, you can follow that, but understand, it's not that he's holding information back from you, although he may be. It really is, if he dumped all that information on you, you couldn't function in this world. It would overwhelm you. I mean, just think about the fact when you're 15 or 25 or 35 years old, and all of a sudden God just lays out your whole life for you. It'd be like, who knows? I mean, including the day of your death. It'd just paralyze you. It'd be like, oh my, I've got, 365 whatever left. It's like, and then this is going to, it's like, oh no, this, it's like, just, we don't really, you can't function. They'd be called some kind of lunatic. You become crazy. Okay, that's enough of that. That's way beyond our scope of conversation today. Okay. But he obeyed God. He was called. He would later receive his inheritance. He obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob. They're going to receive the same promise. It's going to be handed from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, and that's part of the story, who were heirs with him of the same promise. God is giving him a promise. It is not the, again, this is huge. Again, I this is why I have to keep going backwards, and I shouldn't do this. But he's going to give him a promise, which is an unconditional promise. I am going to do this. I'm going to take you from here to there. That's different than the Mosaic law. This is a covenant. This was an unconditional covenant. I am promising I'm going to do this for you. It's unchanging. No matter how you respond, I'm doing this. Now, that his promise should encourage you to cooperate. The law, in Moses' case, was a conditional, meaning I will do this, but understand, you're going to have to do this to get this. We're entering into... This is buying a house. You can buy my house for this much money. So here's the money, here's the house. But you don't show up with the money, I'm not giving you the house. This was a contract. And the Jews had to meet their end of the contract, otherwise they wouldn't get the blessing. But the blessing was here, if you obey. Right here, here's the formula. If you obey, you get the blessing. If you don't obey, you disobey, well, what happens over here? You get cursed. It's like the answer to this, when God offers this to you, you say, no, I'm not signing that contract. Because this is based on God's ability to always bless. and his ability to always curse, and you're betting that you're going to be able to always obey to stay in this column. But you can't. You won't. No one ever has. You're going to end up over here disobeying, and you're going to end up getting the curse. So the advice to the Jews of Moses' day would be, don't do it. He comes down and says, can you do everything I said? They says, yes, we can. All right, come up here and sign the papers. And then they entered into the Mosaic Covenant. Jesus fulfilled the Mosaic Covenant. And if you look at the book of Galatians, whenever there's any confusion in the New Testament of people wanting to go to the law, and this is important, the law was set aside, but the promise of Abraham continues. And this is different. This is unconditional. God is going to take Abram, and he's going to do this for him. And all of eschatology is based on God fulfilling this promise, including the cross. Now, the cross was the ultimate sacrifice. This was pointing to the cross. But once we finish the cross, once Jesus has died on the cross, been resurrected, the law is no longer possible. In fact, if you want to get into that law, Paul says anyone under the law is under a curse. Why? Because of your nature. You can't do you can't be 100%. So he says, but we are sons of Abraham. We do have the same faith as it. That's Romans. That's Galatians. That's the whole context text here. And that's that right there changes Christianity for a lot of people. People who want to become Jewish and go back to the law of Moses, you understand, they ended up in captivity, into slavery with famine and drought and all kinds of invasions because they failed to do the law. If they could just come up here and trust God, they could stay in this promise of Abraham, which was fulfilled in Christ. And this is, again, your salvation is coming through the Abrahamic covenant. Your salvation does not come through the Mosaic covenant. All right, that explains when you see this word promise. I'll go on. By faith, Abraham, when he called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to a city with foundation whose architect and builder is God. This is a huge verse right here. Abraham was looking forward to something he did not see. He was not going to see it in the land of Canaan. He did not see the city. Oh, someday I'm going to move into that city. It was not here. It was a city that wasn't part of this world. It's a city from God. It's architect and builder's God. Then it opens up a whole other category. It's going to come up in chapter 12, where that is going to be the city that of the heavens. It's going to be God's city. It's where we're going to go upon our death. But also, eschatologically, that city is going to come to the earth. It is an eternal city. And Abraham's never going to see it on this side of history. So he was looking forward to that. It's going to come up. That's going to be a big topic here in the rest of the book. Verse 11, by faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, and this is a verse we're going to have to do some work with when we get to it, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this old man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. Then it goes on in verse 13, says, all these people were still living by faith when they died. And so far all they've mentioned is Abel and Noah and Enoch and now Abraham and Sarah. And they are all living to a place where they hadn't entered in and received the unseen yet. They're still living by faith. So part of the Christian life is you're going to receive so much in life, but a lot of it is just merely going to be a promise that you're living by faith, waiting for it to happen, and you're going to live and die and never actually receive it until the coming age. And that's Christianity, and that's really a twist on some of the modern churches and modern theology. It's like you're not getting your promise fulfilled today. You're not getting what God his ultimate fulfillment of your purpose here in this age. You're passing through. We're not passing through the land of Canaan. We're passing through life like foreigners. We can see Peter picks up on this illustration in his own writings. We're foreigners looking for a land, and our land is heaven. We're going to live and function here in the temporal world, as you're going to see Abraham doing. He had possessions. He had plenty of things. But eventually, we're going to live and die and have to go somewhere else for the ultimate fulfillment. Now, with that being said, I want to go back to Genesis chapter 11. And this, again, is a ridiculous thing to do, but I sometimes am not any smarter than to try the ridiculous, and I apologize for that. But we talk about Abraham, and it's an example. But as a Bible teacher, I feel the need to have at least read the context or the text of Abraham's life. Because as we read through this, and I'm not sure how this is going to work or if it's going to work, you can see God interacting, these promises being made, where Abraham is in his life. And the map is going to be important. So very quickly, our first map, here's the Mediterranean Sea. This is Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. This is the Euphrates and Tigris River. Do not use this map for travel purposes. Up in here would be Haran in that area there. Here's the border of Syria and Turkey today. This is Mount Zaphon, right there. We talk about the in the north here. And Abram's going to come from Ur, along with his father Terah and his nephew Lot and all the things they have. And they're going to travel. This is a travel route up here. They travel up. They didn't travel across. This is desert. They come up here, and they spent 5 years in Haran. And then after his father Terah dies, Abram leaves and heads down into the promised land. So in the places he's going to go first is going to be the place Shechem is right there. Shechem. And that's going to have Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal on the north and south. There's an altar yet today. You can see the ancient altar and the ancient temple mentioned in Judges. Probably the location where Joshua was at. And there's a tree and an altar that Abraham's. There's a holy site right there. It's still there today. I've got pictures of it. I've been there. Just recently on Mount Ebal, they found that curse tablet. I mean, a few weeks ago it came out. They found a curse tablet dated back to 1200 BC, where it would have been there from the time of Joshua, because Joshua came here, and this is where they renewed the covenant, the Mosaic covenant. From Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, they read parts of the law back and forth to each other and renewed the covenant right here. Well, that's where Abraham's going to go to Shechem. After that, he's going to go down to a place called Bethel, and he's going to build another altar. From Bethel, you can look across right here and see Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where he's going to see that. A lot of times it's down here, but it's been located. It's been found right here. That's where this comes from, right here. This comes from the excavation at Tel Hamon from 1000 B.C. in one of the layers going down. This is actual a piece that comes from there. Someone brought that back for me, who's an archaeologist working there. And that, so when you talk about Bethel, you can look right across here through the Jordan Valley and see that place. And that's going to be important in our city. Then he's going to eventually travel down, and the Negev is way in the bottom. The Negev, or here's Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. This is the Negev. That's the wilderness down here. Salem is right here. That's going to be Jerusalem. It's occupied by the Canaanites. Melchizedek's the king. We'll put Bethel here, Shechem there, and you get your own maps there in your Bible. And that's where we're going to see him go very quickly. And he's going to end up down here in Egypt. So here we go, chapter 11. It says, this is chapter 11, verse 27. This is the account of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And those people are all going to move up here in the north. And that's where Abram goes, gets his son, his wife, as he goes up here towards Haran, because that's where the family had moved to. Chapter 12, verse 1. The Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. So he's supposed to leave his culture. He's supposed to leave his family, and he's supposed to go to a new land. Now, he doesn't know exactly what this means or where he's going. He's going to wander through this land, worshiping God, obeying God. And it's very interesting. Let's talk about this real quick. Abraham is not just a guy on a motorcycle just scooting across the nation, you know, stopping at truck stops and just kind of living the free life. He's got not just a wife on a camel, but he's got possessions, tremendous possessions. He's got people that work for him in his own household, servants. If you want to think more of a sheik, think more of a sheik. So when Abram travels, it's not a guy pulling into town on a motorcycle, jumping off and, you know, just checking out the local restaurant. It's like, I don't want to say an invasion, but it's a mass of people moving in. And they've got herds. They've got animals. They've got possessions. And it appears that Abram is some kind of a warrior because of a couple reasons. That's one of the things that why they the kings, like almost like the Greek city-states, they would each city had like a king. We're going to see Abimelech over here in the Philistines before the Philistines were the Philistines of David's day, because these are still the Philistines over here in the Gaza Strip at this time, but they were still Semitic. They were still of that area. It's going to be around 1200 BC, 800 years after Abraham, that the sea people, the Greeks, are going to invade, and they're going to intermarry with the Philistines, and they're going to become, this is all proven archaeologically in DNA and in hieroglyphics and drawings and other findings they've got. They were Greeks, and they married in, and then they become another type of Philistines. They assimilated but brought their culture in right here, and that's where you're going to have, that's another whole story. So when we talk about the Philistines here, Abimelech, which name means my father is king, Abimelech, that's a royal name, it's a common name. It's going to pop up throughout the Old Testament. My father is king, which means now I'm the king. Why are you the king? My father was king. That's why I'm the king. It's called royalty. It's foreign to, that's becoming more familiar to Americans. But nonetheless, it's supposed to be foreign. And so that's all going to be interacting right there. And why did I go there? Oh, he's a warrior. Like if he came down and he's going to have apparently a contract or an agreement with Melchizedek, because he would use this land outside the city. Each city would have a king, potentially, a local chieftain that was in charge, and then they, to protect their city from the other cities, guys would make contracts or agreements with them, and then they'd travel and use the land, but they were also called to have go to war if they needed to. That is why you're going to see over here when Sodom is invaded by the four kings from the east, Abraham, it says, he's going to mount up men from his own people, his own group, armored men, and they're going to go to battle. And four kings that marched over from the east together that defeated five kings over here, Abram's going to go up and defeat them at night and bring back all the plunder. Now, a guy with an old woman on a camel doesn't do that. A guy with a bunch of sheep doesn't, you know, who's just a shepherd with a staff doesn't do that. But a man who's a sheik with a powerful, he's got possessions, he's got flocks, he's got servants. And when it comes time, why would you let him use your land? Why would you let him just come into this country and use the land? Because we could use a guy like you. We'll let you use our land, but you've got to work for us. And that's why when the king of Sodom tried to say, hey, I'll make a deal after he defeated the kings, we'll see it if we hustle. He says, I will make a deal with you. You can keep the possessions, just give me the people. And Abram says, I don't want a thing from you. I don't even want a shoelace. Because I don't want you being able to say, I made Abram rich. And that's not just a boast. I got rich by myself. I don't want you to say, I put stuff into Abraham's camp. And so now, Abram, you work for me. It's like, no, you don't hire me. I don't even want a shoestring. So there's no way you can come back legally and say, well, we gave you this. It's time for you to show up and help us. It's like you are on your own. The only reason I came and helped you guys at all was my nephew got taken. Family was more. He went and rescued Lot, brought him back, and then the king said, okay, great job. I'd like you to work for us. You can keep all this stuff, and we'll just rebuild with the people. Abraham says, no, take my name off that contract. He said, I raised my hand to the Lord God Almighty that I would not sign a contract with you. Now, interesting, Melchizedek, he gave a tithe. He gave a tithe to Melchizedek. He reckoned, in other words, here's your share. So there was a contract, and you can see other places, Mamre, Eshcol, Aner, that he had contracts with, and he was working with these Canaanites. The Canaanites of this time are not the evil Canaanites of Joshua's time. That's 400-600 years into the future. Those are the four generations are kicking in right here. In fact, God uses four, he says, in four generations. He says, the sin of the Amorites, another word for the Canaanites, is not yet full. And so these people, even Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High, which was the same God that Abraham worshipped. In fact, Abraham is going to bring Isaac up to Salem, up to Mount Moriah, where there was probably a holy place, just like there was at Shechem, that was where Melchizedek worshipped God Most High, and that's where Isaac's going to be offered. So it appears very clearly Melchizedek and Abram worshipped the same God. And that's like, well, how can that be? Well, because God is a universal God. God is not just the God of Abraham, although he's identified Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. We've already gone through, you know, several centuries, millennium of people, and God was known by many, many other people. That's another whole conversation. All right, so here we go. Leave your country, your household, your father's house, and go to the land I'll show you. Now, verse 2 is the first promise. I've got it underlined there. It's the promise of a nation, the little notes at the top. This is the promise of a nation he's just making a promise. He's going to make a covenant in a little bit. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. You work for me, and if anyone comes against you, I will take them out. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And that is an open promise. All people will be blessed through you. What? Abraham's going to come up with some great technology or something? Well, yeah, I suppose you could say that. But ultimately, he's talking about the Messiah, that all the sin issue is going to become. See how open that is? It's pretty broad. His name is going to be great. Well, his name's great today. You've got a variety of people in the Middle East, nations that come from him. So he's not just going to be the father of a nation. He's the father of nations. Now, again, only one of those, this is important, only one of those nations has the Abrahamic covenant. Does that make sense? You're going to right away, you're going to start having children. You're going to have Ishmael and Isaac. Well, Ishmael is not going to be part of the covenant. He's going to be Abraham's son. He's going to become a great nation. God will bless him, but not with the Abrahamic covenant. That goes to Isaac. Isaac's going to have Esau and Jacob, twins. So what, are we going to split the covenant? No. One is going to be chosen. The other is going to become a great nation, the nation of Edom, but not the Abrahamic covenant. That goes to Isaac. And also realize sometimes it's not based on character. It's not based on, well, let's see. Let's just see who earns it. Let's see who can be the most righteous. Let's see who can be the most godly. It's like, no, before they are born, you're the one. And he gets it. Now, God is going to, the promise is what's valuable. The person is just the vehicle the promise is manifesting in. Then Edom becomes a great nation. And then Jacob goes into 12 tribes, 12 sons, and those then are going to receive, that becomes the nation. And that's another whole story. But Abraham, as we read through this, is going to, after Sarah dies, is going to marry Keturah and have many other sons, many sons. And they're all going to be sent to the east. They're all not going to stay there and split up and fight with Isaac. They were given a huge portion of an inheritance and then sent east. Now, my sons wish, maybe I had my favorite son. Zach would say it was him. Okay, let's say that, Zach. You received the Galenic covenant. But all my other sons, they'd be fine with that as long as I would give them a large inheritance and send them somewhere. They're already went somewhere. They just didn't get this huge chunk of inheritance. But Abraham is able to send his sons away, not with here's money for gas. You know, I don't even do that because you're fine. I'll keep my money. But Abraham is able to send them off with a huge inheritance, and they all become nations. Through time, they all become nations in the Middle East. So there is a huge family bond, but in the Middle East, but only one of those nations has this promise. The others are Gentile nations. God will bless them. God will work with them as long as they're following God. But once they go off track, they're eliminated from history, like Edom was, like other nations were. Israel, when they disobey God, they're disciplined, but we've gone through the minor prophets, even the major prophets. They're promised they're going to be disciplined, promised something's going to happen. But at the end, it always says, but in the end, in the end times, in future days, I will bring you back. Edom is gone forever. They're gone. Other nations are gone forever. They've intermarried. The Philistines are gone. They don't exist anymore. Israel was put away, but restored. They're still here today because this covenant. You want proof the Bible's true? We're reading chapter 12 of Genesis, and we've got 65 more books to go. And in chapter 12, we still got, what, we got still got 38 chapters to go, and then 65 more books. In chapter 12, it says, I'm going to make you a great nation. Your name is going to be great. I'm going to give you this land. Now, 2022, well, these things are all obscure. They're obsolete. They're not true anymore. This is just ancient writing, except for the fact that everybody knows who Abraham is. You've got the Christians, you've got the Jews, you've got the Muslims. Everybody in the Middle East wants to somehow get a piece of Abraham in their name because it's like, we're the people. It's like, Israel is the people, here's the land, and Abraham has become many nations. Right there, well, the Bible's Yeah, it's not true. It's just a legend. That's a pretty cool legend right there that just is like in the news today. It's like legends, you're no longer reading stories about Hercules and Zeus and all these legends unless you go to some university and study Greek mythology. Now, that's another conversation for another day about what those powers were. Because those demonic powers are going to come back. That's another conversation. But this right here, and that's also in the Bible. But anyway, here we go. So Abraham left as the Lord had told him. He's leaving from Haran, coming down to the land. As Lord and Lot went with him. So that would be his nephew. His Lot's father had died. Abraham was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Now, Sarah's with him, Lot's with him, and some of that's where the story ends. A couple camels, and here they come. But all the possessions, which would mean caravan, and all the peoples, which would mean employees and servants and military, that's traveling with him. And it's like, are you sure? Well, it doesn't say all that, but it just says all the people. But as you start flipping through these pages of the rest of the story, you're going to see those people are workers. They're servants. Some of them are wealthy themselves, and then when it comes time for war, they're able to mount up, get their weapons out, and ride off on horses, probably, to battle, and then come back and having defeated other nation states. It's like, whoa, was that? So that's your verse, but it's defined as you go through later. Does that make sense? I don't want to add more to the story, but I definitely don't want this to become just a little Sunday school story, that here's an old man and old woman coming in. It's like, and they got this promise, and they're talking about this God somewhere that no one knows. All the way through this land, people know of this God. And you're going to hear Abimelech talk about him. In fact, the Lord is going to appear to Abimelech. You're going to hear Pharaoh talking about the Lord. It's like, so he's not in an area, when you talk about the Lord, that they're all, you know, again, there's many other things going on religiously. But when Abraham comes in and mentions his Lord, it's not a new concept. Okay. Abraham traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Morah at Shechem. The great tree of Morah at Shechem. And we've been there. The tree's gone, but there would have been a great tree probably, potentially planted as a memorial tree, or at least a marker. It was a huge tree. He made it there, probably right between. The topography hasn't changed. There's Mount Gerizim, there's Mount Ebal, then there's this valley, and right there today is the remains of a temple mentioned in the book of Judges, and there's still an altar there with a standing stone. The standing stones would represent the point of contact with the deity. That's where they'd pour out the drink offerings, or where they'd come and make contact with the god. That's right there at Shechem today. It's like, are you sure that's the right? Well, I'm not sure it's the same location, but when you step into the valley between Ebal and Gerizim, it's kind of like, well, this is ancient, and it's not like one day they just up and moved it somewhere. This is probably a long-standing tradition right here that this was the place. And you can go there today and see it. It's in the West Bank, so it's treacherous in some cases to get in there. Anyway, that's where they're at. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Now, this is interesting because that kind of gives you right there. There's certain times there's like edits in here. And this is called textual criticism. There's higher textual criticism where you try and destroy the whole Bible. It's all just legend, all just made up. But there's also the idea that this is a legitimate document that was handed out. This is the account of, you know, Joseph or Jacob. This is the account of Seth. This is the account, whatever. This is the totally dote of Terah, the written account of Terah. But then Moses put together the first five books of the Bible, and he would have edited Genesis. So it's possible right here that as Moses is putting these documents together, and they are a collection of documents, it says right with it, this is the document of Seth. This is the document of Lamech. This is the document of, it says it right here. So it's sewn together of these documents, edited together. And it is possible right here that this would be textual addition right here. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Now, Moses would, I don't know, but someone would have then later come back and said, here's the story. And then you guys say, okay, now listen, the Canaanites were in the land at that time. So they're there, but they're not the same Canaanites that you know today. So there's a little bit of editing going on there. That doesn't make the Bible untrue. It means it makes it even more a historical document that was watching the events on the ground as it was being put together. And that comes up throughout the Bible. I'll talk more as we go. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. So right here at Shechem, probably between Ebal and Gerizim in the valley right there, the Lord appears. Now remember, he appeared to him in Ur of the Chaldeans. Stephen said that. We saw that last week in Acts chapter 7. The Lord of glory appeared to Abram in Ur of the Chaldeans. It says, go to the land, follow. Now he's right here. And now he comes here, stops here to worship God, and the Lord appears to him and says, this is you're here. This is the land. I'm going to give this land to you. And Abraham worships him, built an altar there who had appeared to him. So, I mean, there it is. It's a confirmation this is the land. Verse 8, from there he went on towards the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. So right down here, he goes this way. Bethel's on the west, Ai's on the east. And they didn't know where Ai was, but they have now, there are several sites right there, because remember when Joshua comes in, he defeats Jericho, then Ai defeats Joshua. It's a little village. And they had like three or four places. Everybody would guess. They mark it there. They have now excavated it. They've got on the ground proof. They know where Ai is at right here. They've excavated it. And so Ai is right there. And notice right here, from here, the hills east of Bethel, there's the hill country here. And from those hills, you can stand today even. You can stand and the ground goes down to the Jordan Valley, goes down. It's flat and rises up towards, there's a plain right here, and it rises up to the mountains over here in Jordan. And from Bethel, you can stand on those hills of Bethel and look over the Jordan Valley and see Sodom. You can see the remains of Sodom there today. Now, again, that's being excavated. 20 years ago, it was down here. They guessing where it was. This is now basically confirmed. I mean, I can tell you more about it. They've down to the destruction layer. They've got where that solar blast. They've studied it. They've got evidence of it, melted pottery. They've got bones, and it's all the blast is the same way. In rooms, this is just a synopsis of it. In rooms, the pottery at this level has been blown across and smashed into the wall and broken, along with bones and bodies that were over here. Nothing's over here, but it's all gone this way. It was a solar blast that took it out in a moment. And that's what they're excavating now. This was at the 1000 BC level, because they eventually built over it again, eventually. It was barren for like 400 years because it was covered up with salt water, because it would have blown all the salt water up out of the Dead Sea and just wiped out this fertile ground. It was dead for 400 years. Nothing happened because like there's nothing here. It was like the Garden of God until buried in salt water, everything blown away, and for 400 years it was just a place of the dead. And then they eventually began to build. This was in about the time of David's. They built up. This is David's lair. So they found this. They found many of those things. And so it wasn't like I've got some valuable piece of archaeology. That's why they allowed me to have it. But then they just kept digging down through the layers and eventually got to 2000 BC or wherever that's at. And they're at the destruction layer. They've got the city gate. They're doing excavation on it continually every season, which is pretty cool. I know a couple people that have worked there and go back and forth. Okay, so anyway, we're way ahead of the story, but that's from Bethel. You can see right here. Now that changes the whole story. That's where Abram's going to be when it says, when the Lord talks about destroying Canaan or destroying Sodom. He's in Bethel, in the hill country here. If he's looking way down here, you can't see that. I mean, it's like he looks and he's looking at it, and he goes up the next morning and sees the smoke rising. It makes really visually, I mean, you can see whatever you want to believe is fine, I guess. But it makes no sense archaeologically that Sodom's down here. You couldn't look at it with the Lord from Bethel. You couldn't see the smoke rising from here. But over here, it's like, you know, there you can just stand there and see it. I can stand there and see it today, depending on how clear the air is, you know, if it's full of air. Okay. East there, he built an altar right here, east of Bethel. Then he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord, or Yahweh. Then Abram set out and continued towards the Negev. So he stops here, builds an altar at Bethel here, goes right past Salem, down into the Negev down here. Now he's just arrived in the land. He's 75 years old. Now how many weeks, months that takes, it doesn't give you the detail. Now there was a famine in the land. Now again, is that right away the next week, or is that a year later? I'm not sure. And Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, okay, so there's a famine here, which is common. He's going to go down to Egypt, and they're going to have land or crops because when the Nile floods, as you know, it flows this way. When the Nile, it comes out of the mountains of Egypt, or further down of Ethiopia, further north, or excuse me, south. It flows down, it floods, and makes the ground fertile, but also watered, and they plant crops. It's the life stream of. So when this has got a famine, you can always go down to the Nile River, and they've got crops right there. Now, Abram, again, is not just the guy showing up looking for a hotel room to spend a few months. He's coming in the land with possessions, with people. He didn't just, me and Sarah are going to go on vacation to Egypt. We'll be back later. Good luck, you guys. Watch the crops or watch the cattle. He's going to come down with his possessions. And he's concerned because, well, here's what he said. Now, here's your man of faith. Again, this is what's brutal about the Bible and the account, is there's no heroes in it. Now, you can do whatever you want to with this. It's just when you read this, it's kind of like, this does not sound like the mighty man of faith. He's the mighty man of faith because God told him and he's believing God. But Abraham, just like you and I, are still dealing with life. I mean, it's like he's worshiping here. Great guy. What a great man of God. Great man of God. Well, now he's down here in the Negev. What are you doing down here? Well, we're down here now. We've got a famine. Now, did he make a mistake? Is this a test? Is he in the wrong place? Did he go too far south? Should he go back up to we don't know. But he's down here with a famine. We know he's got a lot of people. We know he's got animals, lots with him, and lots developing his own system, his own, you know, family, own account, own business. And now it's a famine, and they're going to starve. So he's going to go to Egypt, but he realizes we're entering dangerous territory. And, I mean, and many of us men know this problem. I understand this problem. You'll see. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. So say you are my sister, so that I will be treated with well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. Honey, listen. When the men of Egypt see you, they're going to want you. So, obviously, you're part of my program, but if they kill me, now you're available. So, they're going to kill me. As soon as they see you, they're going to go, aha, let's kill Abram. So, I'm going to need you to say you're my sister. Yeah, no, we're just traveling together. We're just traveling. I just take care of my sister, a family responsibility. Yeah. She's just beautiful. Yeah, well, whatever. And then they'll go, hey, we buy Abraham drinks, kind of give him some little gifts, take him out for lunch. It's like, hey, can I meet your sister? Wow, sure, come along. Here's my sister, Sarah. And they'll treat me good. Instead of killing me, they'll give me gifts and treat me good. You going to do that? Sarah's like, I don't know if that's a good idea. Come on, honey. I don't want to die. So Sarah apparently plays along with the game. Now, we have never done that, but I'm talking about my wife being a beautiful woman and the other men being jealous and stuff. Okay, here we go. So there you go. When Abraham came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was very beautiful. Isn't this amazing? I mean, as you read this, it's in the biblical account, but you've got Abraham following the promise. You've got the promised land. You've got altars and worship, and you've got all these locations. Now there's a famine. They're going to go to Egypt to get some food. And then we take a break, and we tell this ridiculous story, which I believe it's true. I'm not saying it's ridiculous since it's not true, but it's like, why? Who cares? I mean, it's like, Abraham is now telling that this is his sister, lying about this situation. Sarah's playing along. They come in. And the whole story now pivots to how beautiful Sarah is. It's like, what's that got to do with the Abrahamic covenant? I mean, it's just one of those things. It's a question. Like, I think about it. It's like, why are we talking about how beautiful Sarah is? Can't we just say Abraham went down to Egypt and then left after the famine? But we got to talk about Sarah's beauty and what took place there. And so here it is. It's in the Word of God. So here it is. And this is one of those things when you question, like, it's like, why is this here? Sometimes you get, aha, I can tell you why it's here. But sometimes I say, why is this here? I don't really know. But it's there for, that's one of the things you put on the shelf and go, someday you'll be reading somewhere and go, wait a minute, I know why this is here. So there's certain things in the Bible. I'm a Bible teacher and I've taught through the Bible several times. But sometimes you get to something And I just don't have a good answer. Now, someone else may have a better answer, but what I don't want is a stupid answer. Well, because, and then you give some weak, lame answer. It's like, wait, this is here for a very important reason, and I don't know what a very important reason is. And maybe you can figure it out. Maybe you already know. Maybe you're saying, why are we still talking about it? But here we go. When Abram came to Egypt, verse 14, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. And so, of course, she's a beautiful woman, comes in the land, and the word goes around the street. The officials, the princes that work with Pharaoh, they hear about it, like, wait, this is Pharaoh material. And so all the street people like, whoa. That moves up the ranks to the officials. They go, whoa. And then they go, this is someone you're going to want to meet. Why didn't you guys do that? We know if we take her, you're going to kill us and take her. And so no one's going to touch Sarah because, Pharaoh, this is a woman for you. That's how beautiful Sarah was. Now, remember, she's 10 years younger than Abram. And so if he's 75, she's 65. So she's got a good skin care treatment that she's using and has a great exercise program, apparently. And her hairdresser travels with her. I don't know. And the Pharaoh's officials she was taken into the palace. He treated Abram well for her sake. So now Abram shows up in Egypt, and guess who's the first person that you see him meeting? Pharaoh. I mean, I've traveled different places, and the first person I meet is like, you know, the person at the hotel or the Quick Trip or something. It's like, I've even gone to Washington, D.C. And it's like, I stood outside the White House, looked at it, you know, looked through the fence, took some pictures. But no one came out and introduced me to anybody, let alone the president. And so it's interesting that Abram comes into the land and he gets access straight to the Pharaoh. And one of the reasons is his wife. I mean, what opened the door? In this story, just that simple account, his wife is so beautiful that Sarah is the one that gets promoted to Pharaoh. And Abram says, hey, yeah, that's my sister. And it's like, and so now, well, come on in, Abram. Come on in. You want something to eat? And they invite, now Pharaoh and Abram are hanging out together. So just interesting, Abram now, from Ur to Haran, wanders through this land. Again, it's hardly wandering. It's a caravan marching through it. And now he's here. And now he's in Pharaoh's presence. He treated Abram well. And Abram, what do you mean treated him well? Bought him supper, a cup of coffee. No. Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. Now that doesn't mean that's where he got them from. That's where he brought that into the land already, and that's what he takes down. He was given more. And what this sounds like, it sounds like a dowry. It sounds like, hey, Abram, I like you so much. I'm going to buy your meal. Here's some sheep and some cattle. Here's some male and female donkeys. You can add to your herd, start producing. You can fire your business up. And here's some men servants and maid servants. And hey, here's some camels. Well, thank you. What a nice meal. Now, that's got to be more than just, hey, treating him nice. It's like there was an exchange. There's a purchase being made right there. Abram got in so deep. Now, again, it doesn't say it in the text, but Abram got so deep into this, say you're my sister so they don't kill me, so they'll treat me well. And things are going so, this gimmick is working so well that Sarah has been taken into the palace of Pharaoh. Abram, how far is this going to go? And Abram's like, hey, and then here comes the camels. It's like, ho, God is blessing me for making good decisions or whatever. I mean, I threw that in. But it's like, if I were to receive that today, my life would change. I mean, my status would change financially. And Abram's already well-to-do. He just became wealthier in Egypt. And how does this end? How does this end? Well, here's how it ends. The Lord ends this stupid charade right here. But the Lord, Yahweh, inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife, Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abram and says, what have you done to me? Now, how the heck does he figure this out? all of a sudden, there's some kind of disease in the household. And again, it doesn't tell you what the disease was. It just says all of a sudden there's an affliction, and you can start putting pieces together and speculating, which is a fun game to play right there. But all of a sudden it's like, wait, but somehow they isolate it to, this is because of her. Who are you? And maybe she told the story, but it's the Lord's name is in this whole thing, and Pharaoh's going to know that the Lord, Yahweh, is doing this to him, and I've been deceived. And now listen, I've done nothing wrong here. I handled this like a professional businessman as king of the country. I purchased her. I bought a dowry from her, brought her into my harem, and all this takes place. I'm just doing business straight and narrow like you're supposed to. Abraham, what are you doing? What happened? Okay, well, and now the hero of faith that we're going to be, again, in Hebrews, have the faith of Abraham. Okay, so like when crunch time comes, you sell your wife? It's like, okay, here it is. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say, she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? So that was a dowry. He took her to be his wife. Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. He kicks him out of Egypt. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. He says, I don't want anything to do with this. You keep the dowry, take your wife, and get out of my land. So there's your example of righteous Pharaoh and, you know, crooked, lying, you know, Abram. And so here's who's the hero of this story? The pagan Pharaoh was like, that's not right. And the Lord is intervening in the whole thing. There's that story. I mean, it's like, okay, so he leaves and he's more wealthy. Verse 13 continues to talk about the wealth, chapter 13. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev. He comes out of Egypt, back up here to the Negev, the wilderness area here, with his wife and everything he had. Now, when it says everything he had, doesn't mean a backpack. Again, you understand that's it's a caravan. It's a huge a moving military with cattle, sheep, camels. Abram had become very wealthy in livestock, and we haven't mentioned this yet, in silver and gold. So it's not just animals and possessions. He's got silver and gold he's stockpiling. Remember, he's going to send his sons away eventually, all of them, with a great inheritance and not leave a dent in Isaac's inheritance. From the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar. There Abram called on the name of the Lord. So it goes from place to place. This one talks about him wandering. Where is he going? Where are you going, Abraham? I don't know. This is the land I'm supposed to travel in. So he's traveling. He comes back to Bethai, between Ai and Bethel, the same location, and worships God again there. Now, Lot, who was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. So not only they've got two camps, they've got two businesses. And he's got his own cattle, flocks, herds, tents. And tents means he's got people. I mean, he doesn't have a lot of tents. He said, which tent am I going to sleep in tonight? He's got tents, which all these tents represent the people that are Lot's. But the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were too great that they were not able to stay together. So when he comes up, both of them have so many animals that when they come up to work in the land, they're not just they're traveling, but they've got to have some kind of agreement with the people they're traveling by, covenants, that all of a sudden it's like we both can't work, we can't have a Walmart and a Target right beside each other. It's like, We're destroying each other's business. We got to decide what we're going to do. In fact, they started fighting. Abraham's servants started fighting with Lot's servants for the parking lot space or the water and the crops or the grass. So here it is. And quarreling, verse 7 of chapter 13, and quarreling arose between Abram's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. So now, right there, they're identifying some of the people. Some of them are their workers, their herdsmen. They're watching the sheep. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So besides Lot and Abram, there's also other warrior sheiks, whatever you want to call them, that are living in the land doing the same thing. It's a business. You protect your areas you're working in, and they're doing the same thing. And so the land's getting crowded. So Abram said to Lot, "Let's not have any quarreling between you and me, or between your herdsmen and mine." And a reason for that is, well, it's not good for the family. We shouldn't argue. It's because, listen, we're going to end up killing each other. My men will end up drawing swords and killing your men. I mean, it's not just, well, it's not nice to argue as a family. It's like, otherwise we're going to kill each other. It's going to become a war. And then you watch this. They're at Bethel right now. They're at Bethel. This kind of helps set the stage for the Sodom and Gomorrah story, because they're right here. And so Abram says, "Is not the whole land before you?" In other words, look around. We're standing here in Bethel. You can see everything. You can see over here. You can see down here. You can see over towards the coastal plain. You can see up north. The whole land is before you. Let's part company. It's time for us. You need to branch out and go your own direction, and I'll go the other way. We can't be on the same street, on the same corner, having the same business. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. And again, that would be their terminology, right and left. You got the east is where the sun rises. And if you look at it this way, you always look at the sunrise. That's the face. Your back's towards the sunset. And that would make the south right and the north left, if that makes sense. In other words, you go south and I'll go north or whatever. You understand what I'm saying? That when they looked east. And I'm not sure if I'm looking east right now. Thank you. My wife is the direction person. Okay. In my world, on this map, that's east. Yeah, okay. This board is more real than my reality. All right. Okay, God help the teacher. Okay. Lot looked up. See? He's looking east. Lot looked up and saw the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt towards Zoar. Now, that says several things. He's standing here in Bethel, and he looks up. So he's looking forward. He's looking east. This would be left. This would be right, north, south. He's looking here. He lifts his head up, looks this way. And this is the Jordan plain right here because it goes down. And I've talked about driving from Jericho right here, driving up to Jerusalem. It just keeps going up. And because this start in Jerusalem, right after the Mount of Olives, you go up the Mount of Olives, it just starts sloping down to here. And the same way, it's flat. It's flat right here. It's a valley. And it's flat and continues until you get up to the mountains over here in Jordan. So this is the Kakur is right here. It means the disk in the Hebrew. It's the disk. And it's a circular plane. It's a word that pops up in Genesis here, the Kakur, right here. And it's the disk. It's the flat. And this is Zoar, one of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, is over there. There's little satellite cities around Sodom and Gomorrah, And what comes out of these hills? On this side, snow melts and water runs down, or there's water in the mountains runs down. And so this whole land is just water, rivers running through and draining into the Jordan. So this is a plain. It's well watered with or without rain. It's like the Garden of God. It's like Eden, which had headwaters running in it. It's like Egypt, like Sodom, or like Egypt with the Nile River, where it would flood and you have good soil. So they had plenty of water, plenty of good soil. This was a beautiful land. So he's standing here. He looks up and goes, "I'm going there. I'm going to the good land," which was a good decision. And Lot and Abram's not afraid. Lot looked up, verse 10, and saw the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar. And Zoar's over. Now you know where Zoar's at. Could Zoar be here or here or here? Where's Zoar? Look at Bethel. Look east. There's Zoar. And that's what the guy, Dr. Collins, who found this and excavated Sodom, that's what he did. He was giving tours in the 80s, 90s. And they go down here and they go through the places down here. It's on your maps, on your Bibles. Sodom is marked down here. And there's a little question mark trying to figure out where Sodom and Gomorrah is at. So he'd take them, they'd stay at Masada, or they'd stay at Qumran, or they'd stay in some kind of Negev. And they'd go over here and they'd tour drive through the salt plains because there's tar pits and all kinds of salt and stuff here. We've been driven. It's an ugly place. And they said, well, this is a traditional location. And he'd be there. He said one night in one of his books, he goes, I went back to my room after giving the tour, and I'm reading the account in my Bible, and it's kind of like, this doesn't even make sense. Because Abraham, right here, they're at Bethel on the hills east of Bethel, looking east at Sodom and Gomorrah. And he says, that would be here. And that contradicts the biblical account. So he got permission, and he went through and you got to work with the Jordan government, and he went through and marked off all the major, because it's going to have to be a big tell, big mound, it can't be just a little remote rural city. It's going to have to be a large. So he marked off several options, and then decided which one looked the best. They looked which one looks like it could be right here, and well, it looks like this one, Tel Hamam. And they started excavating. And of course, you're now going flat out against all the maps, all the seminaries, all the Bible scholars. And you're over here, you're a crazy man. You're a kook. Because you're like, actually, it should be right there. And it's got to be that one. And now, 10, 20 years later, however many seasons he's excavated, It's right here. And it's like, it's been there the whole time. And again, we could talk more about that, but it's kind of amazing. And like, once again, this right here, this comes from that location. Okay, verse 10. Lot looked up and saw the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt towards Zoar. Parentheses, this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Sodom and Gomorrah were still there. So Sodom, one of the satellite cities, Gomorrah, Zoar, one of the cities. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan. That would be the word Kakar, the disk, the whole disk of the Jordan. He says, I'm going to go down to that disk. It's a fertile plain. So Lot, So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out towards the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. He doesn't move into Sodom. He does the same occupation Abram does. He comes over here and protects Sodom. He's going to work out here in the cattle's going to eat the grass, and he's going to pitch his tents towards here. He's going to pick up. Now, the interesting thing is, the next time we hear Lot is living where? In the city. He's in the city. And how did you get in this? What happened? You're a herdsman. You've got people. And he's in the city. And that, we'll talk about that when we get there someday. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. They themselves had already moved deep into the fourth generation because of their well-watered culture, their pleasant life, their luxury they had. And it says right here, they were greatly sinning against the Lord. And that's all it says. But you flip a few pages over, it makes it very clear. They were very selfish. They were very inhospitable to foreigners, outsiders that would come into the city. And they were steeped in sexual sin. I mean, crazy sexual sins. And we'll see that later. As it goes. So when people start talking about, we should talk about, homosexuality and all this, it's like, well, here's a good place to begin. You live there, you're greatly sinning against the Lord, and here is where you're going. It's not an alternative life. Well, it is an alternative lifestyle. It's a lifestyle of a great sin, which you're going to have great, repercussions. So if you want to introduce that, it's like, well, we need to open people's minds. Well, let's start right here and say, the biblical advice is it's not progressive. It's like, whoa, we're such a progressive culture. It's like, this is Abraham. Abraham hasn't even got a child. Isaac's not even born yet. And these guys are a city steeped in homosexuality, transgenderism. It's totally corrupt. It's like, see, well, they were so progressive. It's like, they got buried with a satellite, a solar atmospheric blast that buried them and destroyed the city for over 400 years and are an example of rebellion towards God. Now today, just like the promise of Abraham is still active and all those things God said are taking place in our news today, this could be advice. This is what happens when you live like that. So it's like, well, that was old time. Yeah, but this is old story is still affecting history today. This is the old days. Yeah, but the God who destroyed that is still God today. So take that in mind. We got to pick that up. And as I said, I wasn't sure how this was going to work. But we'll get through this sometime, and then we'll go back to Hebrews and see what the Hebrews says about Abraham's life and get some insight. I'll pray, and we're done. Father, we thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We especially thank you for Jesus Christ and his resurrection, as that we may experience that life in our life, that we may enjoy the confidence we have of his work on the cross, but also, Father, allow his spirit to transform us into the image of Jesus Christ himself at this time in history, even before your kingdom comes. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.